A very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 063174, Ryan Belcher against Vaughn Norton. Mr. Myers.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Chris Myers, and I represent the appellants Ryan Belcher and Dorena Gleason, who is now Dorena Belcher. They are now married. The facts of this case are relatively simple. On March 1st of 2004, Mr. Belcher and Ms. Gleason went to retrieve personal items out of a van that was towed and stowed at a tow yard in Orland, Indiana. While retrieving their personal items out of the van, a dispute arose between and among the appellants, Mr. Belcher and Ms. Gleason, and the owner of the tow yard and his employees. The police were called, and in the town of Orland, at least at that time, the only police officer was Vaughn Norton. He was the acting town marshal. And he came, and what happened next gives rise to our claim. The dispute.
And one of the things that you allege is that, there was no probable cause for the arrest, and we need to look into the mind of the officer. But isn't the standard that we have to apply when looking at a Fourth Amendment violation? And hasn't the Supreme Court directed us we need to look at whether objective facts support the probable cause to arrest and not the officer's state of mind?
I agree. That's the standard. What I disagree with, what appellants disagree with in this case, is the extent to which the district court applied that concept against the standard of review that the district court normally employs in looking at summary judgment, and that is construing all the facts and reasonable inferences therefrom in favor of the non-moving party.
Well, didn't Norton only know that a radio had been removed? I mean, he didn't know how it had been removed, how it had been affixed to the car, if it was one of those after-installed radios. Wasn't it reasonable for him to assume that the radio was a part of the van?
Absolutely not, and I don't think the record supports that interpretation. This incident lasted for between 45 minutes to an hour. Officer Norton, when he came onto the scene, the facts and reasonable inferences therefrom suggest that he immediately took the side of Mr. McClanahan, who owned Bill's Towing, and the Bill's Towing employees. Immediately, he threatened to arrest Mr. Belcher if Dorena Gleason didn't sign over title to the van to Bill's Towing. And I think that if we look at the facts objectively, Mr. Norton didn't conclude on his own that a theft or conversion had been going on. It wasn't argued by defense counsel in the motion for summary judgment. It wasn't brought up during this case at all, except in the court's sua sponte argument. And, of course, by then, it's too late for the plaintiff to proffer an argument of their own against that interpretation. And that's exactly what happened here. So we think that the district court either misapplied or wrongfully applied the standard of review in getting to the decision that it got to. The court agreed that there was a Fourth Amendment seizure. We agree with that. What we disagree with is that the seizure was unreasonable. We think that the facts, taken in a light most favorable to the plaintiff, suggest a finding that the seizure was unreasonable.
But this confrontation continued when the officer showed up. I mean, what's the man's name?
Vaughn Norton?
No, not him.
Mr. Belcher?
Yeah, he was arguing and continuing to assert, I guess, his right to take the personal property. And I guess when we get into it, as Judge Williams brought up, was with this radio. It's one thing to get court documents and, I guess, medicine and maybe even clothes or something that you were wearing, a sweater or something, but to start taking the radio out of the dashboard.
Well,
that's a little done. Now, that that bothered me.
Okay. And, Your Honor, if I could correct a misunderstanding, there's nothing in the record to support the proposition that Mr. Belcher took this radio from the dashboard.
So this was just a radio sitting in the seat somewhere, huh?
It was one of those pop-in CD players And the record is pretty much silent on this point. There is a reference, I think, by one of the defense lawyers in his questions about, you know, whether it's like a pop-in CD player. And I believe that's attached to the appendix. But in any event, this was not a situation where Mr. Belcher was in there with wire cutters and screwdrivers and a wrench and taking the dashboard part to get to the radio.
So your point is there's at least a genuine issue of triable fact with respect to whether this radio was a fixture or was not a fixture.
Absolutely.
Well, we're on the point. Is there any authority in the state of Indiana that personality left in the car is subject to the mechanics lien?
Absolutely not. And given that absence of authority, I think we have to look at the lien statute itself. The clear wording from the lien statute says that the lien applies to the vehicle, not to the personal contents. But we can look at the facts of this case and look at whether, as the court has already reminded me today, that whether it was objectively reasonable for an officer to think that a theft or conversion was going on. Again, there's no evidence to suggest that Von Norton ever even dreamed that that was a possibility.
Now, there was some evidence about this CD player because in the deposition, didn't Belcher say that the two of them removed the radio from the van and the CD and that it had been installed in the dash and acknowledged that he took the stereo that was in the dashboard?
I don't think he said dashboard. It's one of those CD-like players that attach to the dashboard with brackets. And there's a button that you merely pop in and pop out. And that's what you do to take it out.
Well, I'm just saying I think that's quotes from his deposition. Okay. It was in the dashboard. That's Belcher, the one who removed it. So there was some basis on it. But even if we give you that it was a pop-out CD, aren't we in a qualified immunity kind of situation because it wasn't clearly established that it was a constitutional violation at the time that Norton acted,
you know,
with the search and also with the threat that if she didn't sign it, you know, they'd go to jail?
No, I don't think so. And I will answer your question, I promise. But let me preface it by saying the district court never really got to the issue of qualified immunity. The reason that it was hit, at least by the plaintiff's counsel, by me, is because there was an implicit determination that perhaps the officer's actions in this case were reasonable. But the court never really got to the issue of qualified immunity, so the qualified immunity issue has never been fully briefed.
But, so are you saying that we can't look at this matter through the qualified immunity lens because it wasn't fully briefed below?
That's correct. I think it'd be a little bit unfair to make a decision since the parties never fully briefed the issue below and the court never really ruled on it head on. But having said that, I don't think qualified immunity applies here. A reasonable police officer is bound to know the law. And as one member of the court already indicated, there's simply no authority, particularly the lien statute itself, which would indicate that a tow yard owner has an ownership interest in the contents of a vehicle. It's simply not there.
And you would distinguish between the policy of the owner of the towing yard versus what state law is, I guess.
Absolutely.
Now, as I understand, their policy, of course, they worry about abandonment or whatever they call it, dumping or something.
Correct.
Once you have a car that, a 1988 van that dies on the toll road, there's probably a fairly significant repair needed in addition to the towing, et cetera, and it may be that that car isn't worth redeeming, which I guess they do have that right with it, 20 days or something like that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
that's correct.
So that's what Tom, was that his name, Tom's? Whatever it is, the toll, what's the name of the...
Bill McClanahan owned Bill's Towing.
Bill's, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir.
Okay, anyway, Bill's Towing is concerned about having a car dumped on them.
And they have every right to be concerned about that.
And so they have a different policy than is the state law, I think.
Absolutely.
So whatever the officer did, Norton, he is confined with the state law.
Absolutely. So, I don't think that... the town marshal, even in a town as small as Orland, can take sides in a dispute, apply a policy of the tow yard as against a citizen of Indiana, and perfect the law or affect the law in such a way to disgorge somebody from their property. That's what happened here.
The thrust of your case, then, is that the town marshal acted as judge and jury in a civil case.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What was the towing storage bill on this vehicle at the time of this incident?
Your Honor, I don't know. I don't think that we ever got that far because...
$1 mentioned in the record?
It might have been, but my client signed over, Ms. Gleason signed over title when Mr. Belcher was threatened with arrest, and so they never had to pay the bill.
How did they sign over the title? They just happened to be in the glove compartment and they signed it over? Because normally if a bank makes any loan on it, they have the title.
That's true.
And I don't think I have the title of my car in the glove compartment. How do you sign it over?
I don't know how they did, but they did.
You got to have the title of the car before you got it, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, you're not arguing that, huh?
No. Okay, my light's on. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Myers.
You.
We'll hear next from Ms. Powell.
Morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Myers. My name is Diana Bauer, and I represent the defendants in this case, Vaughn Norton and the town of Orland. I'd first like to respond to one of the questions asked of Mr. Myers, and that was what the storage fees were incurred. We filed a supplemental appendix in this case, and on page 5 of our supplemental appendix is a copy of the police officer rental property report, which lists the towing fee as $125 and the daily storage fee as $15 per day. Now, of course, the evidence in this case is that neither Mr. Belcher nor Ms. Gleason ever had any intention of paying those fees. They came up to the storage yard with no money. They really just wanted to retrieve his court papers and some medicine for her children. There's no evidence in the record that they actually intended to retrieve the van that day once we got into this.
They did ask to use the phone to call a family member to get the money, didn't they?
They asked someone from the tow yard if they could call a family member to bring them some money. But there's no evidence in the record that at the point in time once Deputy Marshal Norton arrived, and he was obviously the last man to the scene, there's no evidence that at the time he arrived on the scene there was any supplemental request made of him personally to make a call to any family member.
In the record, they were not going to try to dump the car.
Correct.
Whether a jury would believe it or not is another question, but there was some evidence in the record that this was not a dumping situation.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, even if Norton had probable cause to arrest, why didn't the seizure become unreasonable when he directed them to either sign over the title or be arrested?
Well, that's the plaintiff's deposition testimony. There's no evidence in the record from Marshal Norton that he actually made such statements. All he ever said to Mr. Gleason was, if you're not cooperative, if you keep being disruptive, I'm going to arrest you for being disruptive.
That makes it a genuine issue of triable fact as to what the parties said, right?
That's there is an issue of fact as to what the parties may have said, but I think the court needs to look at, and again, the standard's been mentioned, whether a seizure to the extent that occurred was objectively reasonable under the circumstances presented to Deputy Marshal Norton. When he shows up at the scene, he talked to individuals from Bill's Towing about what the situation was that had transpired earlier. And so Deputy Marshal Norton, when he arrived, he learned that these people had come up ostensibly to get court papers and medicine out of the van. They were told by the towing yard employees, which is pursuant to the tow yard policy, if you're not going to pay for the stowing, the storage and towing charges, you can't take anything else out of the van. You can't take any other property out of the van. So they took the medicine and the court papers out of the van, but then proceeded to take items out of the van, which they had been told by Bill's Towing.
The car was there for the towing company to retain other personal items that were in the car.
Well, the tow yard's policy itself...
I understand that, but what legal authority was there, towing company, to retain items, the personality in the car?
Well, the lien statute, which is what both sides spent a lot of time talking about in this appeal, gives the tow yard a lien on the vehicle for the reasonable value of the services that have been rendered.
Lien on the vehicle, but is there any authority in Indiana that that lien extends to personalty left in the car?
I'm not aware of any statutory or case law that says that personal property inside the vehicle comes under the statute. On the other hand, I'm not aware of any authority that supports the position being advocated by the appellant that there's some clear demarcation between personal property in a vehicle.
A pretty basic distinction in the law, isn't it?
I guess you could say that.
First year property law. And wasn't your client charged with knowing the extent of the Indiana lien statute? As the town marshal, he ought to know that the lien statute applies to vehicles, period.
As the town marshal, yes, he should know what the lien statute provides. But in any event, he's receiving this information from the Bill's Tow Yard employees as far as what had transpired earlier. And what the district court did, Mr. Meyer's argument about the district court engaging in a sua sponte grant of summary judgment in favor of my clients is simply not correct. One of the issues fully briefed before the district court was whether Marshall Norton's conduct was objectively reasonable under the circumstances to the extent the seizure actually occurred. Our position was it was reasonable to believe that Mr. Gleason was engaging in disorderly conduct, and the district court said, well, there might be a question on whether what he was doing was disorderly conduct, but on the other hand, a reasonable officer, based upon the information provided to him when he arrived, could have reasonably believed that by removing these personal items out of the van on which the tow yard had a property interest, that he was somehow committing theft or criminal misconduct.
Apparently the district court was dead wrong on that. There is no property interest in the personalty. She just was dead wrong as a matter of Indiana law.
I would beg to differ that Judge Springman was dead wrong on what Indiana law was.
You have no authority whatsoever.
And again, there's no authority supporting the other side's position as well.
No authority either, did she?
No, other than the standards that are to be applied in determining whether a seizure is reasonable under the circumstances. The judge did cite that law. And she again refers to the lien statute and a summary of the conduct that was described to Mr. Norton once he arrived on the scene as far as what these two plaintiffs had been doing. So, again, this was not a sua sponte grant of summary judgment. The whole issue of reasonableness of Deputy Marshal Norton's conduct was an issue that was fully briefed on summary judgment. And, again, the district court took the different tact, that being, well, maybe it was theft, maybe it was criminal conversion, but if it was, what he did was objectively reasonable under the circumstances.
I'd like to just get back to the personal property, because this is where I've obviously... you know, there's no problem with the legal papers and the medicine. I don't know what else they were unloading. This was a small car. Was this thing stuffed with personal property, or is that a fact we don't know?
I don't.
It could have been clothes. Is it? What all was in there?
I don't know that anybody specifically set forth in the evidence all the multiple items that were removed from the van. We do have the issue with the radio,
right.
And there is evidence that. Mr. Belcher was putting items into bags that he was removing from the van. So it's some quantity of items. How many it is, I'm not sure.
The other thing, because there are some things, and maybe this is a fact question, maybe not, if the radio or tape player, CD, whatever was there was coming out, generally that means you're not coming back for the car. And also, I think it was in this case or another one that it referred to, where you take out the jack and the apparatus to change a tire that generally comes with a car. There are certain things that probably, when you took a lien on the vehicle, that maybe those could be labeled something like a fixture that stays with the vehicle. I don't know. But that's where I was wondering what, when he arrived, what Norton was informed about, and also the Belcher's attitude. There was a lot of confrontational talk, and that's when we got to the point of the handcuffs and the other things, the sort of confrontation. So that's why I guess what it's faced with. But I just was more curious about the personal property.
And I think if we have something like, you mentioned the jack that you would use to change tires, obviously if he was going to take the tires off the van, that's part of the vehicle, which would come under the lien statute, and I think we could probably...
No, I don't think he was doing that. It's just the apparatus that you can do it. That's interchangeable. You could probably put that in another car or use it for something else.
Correct. But again, there is no statutory or case law authority in Indiana that specifically holds that the contents of the van, including a radio, is something that's not part of the van or part of the vehicle for purposes of the lien statute.
Let me move to one of the due process claims. This car that was signed over is important to the life of the party in that, you know, cars are used to go to work, to the hospital, to the doctor, and when the property that's lost can affect one's livelihood like a car, is a civil suit that can take years to resolve truly adequate?
Well, there's certainly no pre-deprivation remedy that was available because this was random and unauthorized conduct by our deputy marshal,
right,
if it was anything.
Right.
So the next question is there an adequate post-deprivation remedy? And I believe this court has held, and our district courts have held, in the context of seizures of property, that the post-deprivation remedy being a tort claim under the Indiana Tort Claims Act is a sufficient post-deprivation remedy. And I do understand the court's concerns about a van being used in perhaps somebody's livelihood. But again, the case law is pretty clear that there is an adequate post-deprivation remedy available to Ms. Gleason.
Well, one post-deprivation remedy that was not mentioned was the 20-day period in which to redeem the car and to do, you know, to challenge it. You get the car back if you pay, if you do whatever else is necessary. I'm not sure, you know, the initial deprivation had a remedy within that lien statute, didn't it?
Yes, there is a provision that the owner of the vehicle that's been impounded and or seized does have 20 days to redeem the van. To the extent that Deputy Marshal Norton, this is about 3 or 4 days after it had been impounded, so obviously the 20 days hadn't passed. And to the extent that he was not in compliance with that statute, what we have is a violation of state law, which I believe this court has said does not give rise to a constitutional violation. And the issue of qualified immunity was brought up by Judge Williams, and Mr. Myers is incorrect that this was not fully briefed before the district court. We certainly briefed qualified immunity in our memorandum in support of our motion for summary judgment, to which he responded. The district court, because she found the conduct to be objectively reasonable, found no constitutional violation and therefore didn't get to the qualified immunity analysis, but it would certainly be an alternative basis for this court to affirm the summary judgment that was entered by Judge Springman, that being certainly a situation where qualified immunity would apply. There's been no clearly established case law referenced to the court by the appellant that what Deputy Marshal Norton allegedly did under these circumstances is something that no reasonable officer would have done. So given the broad scope of qualified immunity, it's our position that he would have been entitled to qualified immunity had Judge Springman determined that there was, in fact, a constitutional violation. We would therefore ask that this court affirm the summary judgment entered in favor of Deputy Marshal Von Norton and the Town of Orland.
This 20-day time to redeem, was notice given to them? To the appellant, was any notice given? In other words, when she signed the paperwork, and I assume that took place at the towing place,
mm-hmm.
Right? Was she given anything indicating that she had 20 days in which to redeem it?
I'm not aware of her being provided with anything, and there's nothing in the record that she was or was not provided with any documentation. It's just not an issue that was addressed in the evidence that was developed by the parties in this case.
Is there a document that they used to sign over the car in the record?
I don't believe it is. I know that question was asked of Mr. Myers, and he couldn't recall where that was in the record, and I'm unaware of that as well. We do have the document that I previously referred to the court, being the police officer rental property report, and then we have the...
Yeah, but that doesn't lay out what her
rights
are.
No, it doesn't. And the only other document from Bill's Towing is the invoice written up on February 27th of 2004, being in our supplemental appendix at page 6. But there is no documentation in the record with respect to whether she was or was not advised of the redemption rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer. Sir, you have 4 minutes.
Your Honor, thank you very much. First, with respect to immunity under the Indiana Tort Claims Act, it's the appellant's position that Norton enjoyed law enforcement immunity. Therefore, there was no adequate state remedy post-deprivation. It is very, very clear from the record that the only reason that Marshall Norton was there was because of, in his capacity as a law enforcement officer. And the record is replete with instances of him threatening to arrest, which is, of course, an act of a law enforcement officer, but to arrest Belcher unless he signed over title of the vehicle, or Ms. Gleason did, to Bill's Towing.
But that was contested, apparently.
It was contested.
Yes.
But at this juncture, if again, we're reviewing all the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving parties, the appellants, we should get the benefit of that inference. In any event, there is no adequate post-deprivation state remedy in this case because of the existence of law enforcement immunity. With respect to the 20 days, there were some questions about the applicability of the lien statute in the 20 days. All that didn't matter. Why? Because it was cut short by the coerced signing of the title by Dorina Gleason.
That's where it was signed?
I'm sorry?
You say the title was signed?
My understanding is that it was the title that was signed. She had to sign over title. Now, I don't have, obviously I don't have personal knowledge of that, and I can't cite anything to the record, but the record is replete with demands by Officer Norton that Ms. Gleason sign over, I guess it's not the title, sign over the vehicle to Bill's Towing. She did that. Once she did that, I don't think the lien statute and its 20-day notice requirements applied anymore. In any event, they never did really apply between the town of Orland and Ms. Gleason. That was something I think that only applied as between Bill's Towing and Gleason. Bill's Towing was sued in this lawsuit. They settled out. They're no longer in the lawsuit. So the cause of action against Bill's Towing has been resolved. But that doesn't affect the liability of Orland or Officer Norton. And one final thing, while I've talked about them in parallel terms, we're maintaining in this case that Norton was the policymaker for the town of Orland. He was the highest law enforcement officer, the only law enforcement officer for the town of Orland. He acted, and under PEMBAR and other cases decided by the Supreme Court of the United States and the Seventh Circuit, a single act by a policymaker can be policy of the entity, and that's what we're maintaining here. And, of course, there is no qualified immunity for an official act.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel for their fine presentations, and the case will be taken under advisement.